From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on Long Island in 1990. Police made an arrest in a double murder case. They declared that 17-year-old Marty Tankliff had killed his parents and then admitted to the crime. That led to Tankliff's conviction and a sentence of 50 years to life. Here's the problem. Marty Tankliff didn't kill his parents, and there's no evidence that he confessed either. As Tankliff recently told an audience at the University at Buffalo, he was interrogated for hours until officers claimed that he confessed to the murders. But there was no video, no audio, no evidence of a confession. And there was another suspect in the case, a business partner of his father, who had changed his life insurance policy, then faked his own death. But no, investigators said they were content with focusing on Marty. Well, Marty Tankliff spent more than 17 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. But he was privileged enough to hire a private investigator who finally found the getaway driver in the murders. And that helped lead to Marty finally walking free while the true murderer was found. Many people convicted of crimes they did not commit do not have the resources that Marty Tankliff had. According to the National Registry of Exonerations, 153 people were exonerated last year in this country. But how many more might there be if more effort was made to examine questionable outcomes? In the fall of 2015, the University at Buffalo launched a new Innocence and Justice Project. Students work to identify cases where there is a possibility of a miscarriage of justice. We've asked them to come on the show to discuss it, and my guests are joining us from WBFO in Buffalo. So our thanks to our partners and colleagues at WBFO. I'll welcome them now. Professor Kim Diana Connolly is director of the University at Buffalo School of Law's Advocacy Institute. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
John Getz is co-director of the University at Buffalo's Innocence and Justice Project. John, welcome to the program to you.
Thank you, Evan.
And Farina Mendelson is a third-year law student and a participant in the University at Buffalo's Innocence and Justice Project. Farina, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Evan.
John, you reached out to me originally for this, and you've got some Rochester roots to tell us about, first of all.
Absolutely, yes. And in fact, I'm a proud UB Law alumni who still practices in Rochester and getting into those courts virtually daily, and I love it. It's always a privilege to get into the court system.
Well, and go ahead, John.
I was going to say I also have some history myself on these types of cases with a Rochester case with Betty Tyson, who spent 25 years in for a murder she didn't commit.
Yeah, just remind our listeners a little bit more about that case, John.
Yes, back in the 70s, Betty was convicted of murdering a consultant for Kodak. And back then, Kodak was a very big entity, and this was a high-profile case. Betty, who was black, poor, and a drug addict, didn't have all of the resources necessarily to perhaps get a fair trial. And moving fast forward, after her conviction, many people in the community had rallied around her because they did not believe she received a fair trial. Back in the 90s, I took the case on, and we were able to have an investigator work on the matter, and we found what ended up being exculpatory material showing that, in fact, individuals who had testified had provided contrary evidence prior to her being charged.
In that kind of a case, I mean, you know, how, I guess I don't know how to ask this other than to say, how is it that some defendants don't have the benefit of either having access to some of that possible exculpatory evidence, or, you know, how do some of these cases go by without that being accessed and considered?
Well, that is a great question, and it could take the full hour just to answer it.
Yeah.
And I think the first problem with it, Evan, is frankly resources. The public defender's office, for example, in Monroe County, does an excellent job. Ms. Tyson had private counsel back in that time frame, but the resources and overcoming prejudices and not having the team working on a case. So, for example, having an investigator to search for the truth from your perspective and obtaining all of the information you can obtain. And I think a lot of it goes to the issue of sometimes everything from bias to not having the right resources to have these things be vetted out. And candidly, many times it's, in Betty's case, it was a false confession and frankly, a false confession combined with, for lack of a better term, police misconduct that allowed that to occur. But many times you see the reasons from perjury, false accusations, official misconduct, in many cases are mistaken witnesses, mistaken identification, or false or misleading evidence. And then last but not least is what we're just talking about, that inadequate legal defense. And many times those all come together.
So before I get to some of our listeners' questions, I already have a couple of questions. And in fact, we already have a caller on the line with a question. And Bruce and Aronicoid, hang there if you could, because what I want to do is kind of set the broader stage for what's going on at the University at Buffalo. And John, I'll start with you, and then I'll turn to Kim Diana Connolly and then Farina, the student. But I'll start with you, John, because what I have read is that about a year and a half ago, a rather dynamic attorney kind of helped launch this project, kind of created some coursework that would help students before they start to considering these 440 motions and talking to inmates. But he passed away, and that, you know, you got involved. So tell me a little bit more about the background of how this project came together.
That's right, Evan. A gentleman by the name of John Nucciarino, an excellent attorney in the Buffalo community, had been working with Professor Charles Ewing at the law school to create this project. And sadly, just a week before the project was to start, get up and running, if you will, he passed away. And my law partner, Gary Muldoon, was contacted by the law school. Gary actually has been an adjunct faculty member there for years. He was contacted, and then I was also contacted to see if we could keep the program afloat. And quite simply, the answer was, how could we not? We had to do everything we could to make it work. And I've been privileged to work with some excellent students since then, and just making sure we keep the program moving forward.
Roughly 8-10 students at a time getting to work on this project. Is that about right, John?
That's right. We have 11.
Okay.
But 8 to 10 is about where we're at.
Okay. And let me turn to Professor Kim Diana Connolly, director of the University at Buffalo School of Law's Advocacy Institute. You know, Professor, for listeners who might hear, well, you know, this is a school that's devoting a lot of resources, or at least some of its resources, to helping inmates, when we know that most of the people who do spend time in prison or incarcerated are guilty of something. I mean, even John Nucciarino, the man who helped found this, told the university for an article, quote, "Most people in jail are guilty of something, but many of these people are guilty of something less than they were convicted of. There are some who are completely innocent, and the biggest number really didn't get due process and were wrongly convicted. And if you're going to be convicted and spend years in jail, that should be done by the book," end quote. But I'll go back to the beginning. He says most people in jail are guilty of something. And some listeners might think, Professor, that, well, this is a lot of in the way of resources toward a project that, you know, is this what the community needs most? What would you say to that?
I'm going to give you a quick answer, and then I'm also going to ask Farina to speak.
Sure.
The law school is committed to graduating great law students who have wonderful experiences, and we are privileged to have wonderful students come to us. We are privileged to have great adjuncts such as John Getz and Gary Muldoon work with us, and we train law students, and we use a lot of different ways of training law students, and some of them, a great deal of them, are experiential learning. And so this is one of a cadre of options for students that they can work instead of with a textbook, work with clients in need. And so it's a resource where the focus of the class is creating great law students and also doing service. And I think that while there may be some concerns of a great deal of resources going toward this, it's an experience. And I think that that one of the things that's fabulous about these experiences is when you get particular classes, students who are going to be doing various aspects of practice once they get out are getting context-based training. Farina can even speak to that with respect to what's going on in the class that she's in.
Yeah, please do, Farina. Go ahead.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think that not only does the school devote financial resources to the project, but we students devote our own personal time outside of the classroom to ensuring that we do a really good job. And I think that it is all worth it if at the end we can help even one person. So the concept that everybody is guilty, I think it's a little bit difficult because everybody deserves a fair trial and everybody deserves to be treated fairly in the justice system. And I think that it's up to us as students to make sure that that is now happening, even if it didn't happen in the first place. So I think that it's our job to make sure we're thorough, and the amount of resources we do devote personally is all worth it at the end.
Farina, how long have you been a part of this Innocence and Justice Project?
I was actually one of the founding members, so I was on for the entire school year since John came on and Gary did. So Professor John Nutrino accepted me onto the project originally, so I was on for a year, and then we stay on as volunteers in our third semester.
That's great to know, because I've got a lot of questions about how, you know, the kind of experience you've had with it, and we'll get to that. I also have to ask you, Farina, you were one of the original students, and I had read that they took 8 out of 30 who wanted to be part of it. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Very,
it was
very good.
It was a competitive process.
No, it's, I mean, that's an indication of interest on the student level, not just on the university's interest in getting this off the ground. So that's great. Let me ask John Goetz a question, though, that Farina kind of touched on, making sure people get a fair trial. And how many innocent people are incarcerated? According to the Buffalo Law Journal, this is on the question of how many innocent people are currently incarcerated. They write this, quote, "While there is no way to know exactly how many innocent people are in jail, many sources estimate it's between 2.3% and 5% of the national prison population." I mean, if it's 5%, that's one in 20 people. But even if it's the lower estimate, that's one in something like 42 people. That is a huge number of possible people, but the Law Journal doesn't say where those estimates come from. What do you feel is a fair representation for an answer for that question, John?
You know, Evan, when you look at the numbers from research, so for one example is just recently the University of Michigan Law School had just put out information relating to the numbers of individuals, the racial disparity. You know, 47% of the folks who have been exonerated, wrongfully convicted, were African Americans. That's a huge number. But to answer your question, I think there's people that are paying close attention to these statistics. So the 2 to 5%, I think, is an accurate reflection of people that have been wrongfully convicted. And if you look at one of the numbers you had provided earlier during the introductions, believe it or not, the newest numbers from last year are now 166 exonerees from 2016. So that's one exoneration approximately every 1.5 days. So you can extrapolate that by the number of folks that are actually innocent and come up with I think, a reasonable number of 2 to 5%. I think 2 is conservative. I think 5 would be high. I certainly hope it's high. But even recently, Time magazine just put out a wonderful special edition on the Innocence Project, and it references 4%, that they believe it's about 4%. So I think there's a lot of individuals that are paying close attention to these areas of law. And I think that's how those numbers come into play.
Yeah, and John, I mentioned in the introduction Marty Tancliffe, who you recently brought to the University of Buffalo. He, of course, served 17 years for a conviction of killing his parents, which he did not do. And since his release, has become an attorney and, you know, is working on this exact issue. Here's what, according to the University of Buffalo's website, he had to say about some of this. He said, quote, "We as a society get doubly victimized in those situations. We incarcerate an innocent person and we let a guilty person or persons go free to commit additional crimes. We don't have enough resources or enough lawyers doing this litigation," end quote. That's what I wanted to follow up and ask you about, John. Marty's case is one in which, you know, I don't know all of the details. I just know that after some years in prison, he gets to hiring a private investigator. Most people who are incarcerated for a crime they did not commit probably don't have that kind of a resource, I assume. And I would think that part of the reason that the University of Buffalo wants to create an Innocence and Justice Project is just an awareness of that, an awareness that people who might be wrongly sitting in prison for weeks or months or years don't have the chance to have, you know, their own kind of investigation go forward. Is that right?
That is absolutely the primary purpose of the project in my mind. And I think, Evan, you're hitting on a key point that we've been discussing over the last few minutes now, which is the goal of the project is really threefold. First and foremost is to try to help. And I think Farina did an excellent job of explaining the goals of these students. And yes, we do get to cherry pick excellent students, and we have so many that come to us that want to help. It's wonderful, but because of our resources, we can only take those numbers. But back to this point, we want to try to help that person who is innocent or who did not get that fair trial, to make sure that the system gives them the opportunity to show that it can work, even when it broke down the first time. The second part of the project is to teach these students who have tremendous amounts of energy and ability to give them the opportunity to understand that it is rolling up your sleeves. It is doing that hard work of just grinding through to find out if this person is even telling you the truth. And I think Farina will talk some later about that part of the process. And then the third part of the project is really why we're here today, which is to inform the community that the law school is out there. We want to help people, that attorneys, and I'll say this, in the Buffalo community and in really Western and upstate New York, the legal community and the judiciary has been a tremendous moral, has provided tremendous moral support for this project. And that includes prosecutors, judges, obviously defense attorneys, but even civil attorneys, because these folks want to right those types of wrongs.
All right, so before we turn to Farina and for her experience, what we're going to do is we're going to walk through how these, you know, the 440 motions, we'll explain what that is, and how these individuals are kind of chosen, and then what the experience has been. But before we do that, I'll grab our first phone call. It comes from Bruce in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Bruce.
First, I want to say that when I hear about the Innocent Projects and how they've helped, it absolutely brings tears to my eyes. You're doing wonderful work, and it's necessary. I have a couple of pieces after that. I'm wondering, it's great to go catch them afterwards, but why more resources from the law schools aren't being given to the public defenders beforehand to try and prevent some of this, and whether a tie-in there might make sense. And the second part is, I just can't understand why we don't have stronger laws to prevent the police and prosecutors, you know, misconduct on their part. How we can let them get away with it? You take away 17 years of somebody's life, and they get nothing for it. I just can't understand it. It's unconscionable.
Bruce, thanks for the phone call. Some good questions, and I guess I'll start with John and let the guests respond how they see fit there. Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Evan, and yes, Bruce. Thank you for the excellent questions. I would start by saying, I do know that a number of the public defenders and folks in legal aid throughout the communities reach out to the law school, and that there are a number of law students that are clerking at those offices and also the district attorney's office. So I think that there is an attempt to utilize those resources. I'm going to pass it over to Kim in the sense of the academic and the academic problems, if you will, in dealing with cases that may be pending versus this project. And so I'll defer to Kim on that.
So that is an excellent question, is what is the law school using its wonderful student resources to do? We, in fact, do have externships for credit where students can go out and get credit in public defender's offices. We also, a number of years ago, instituted a criminal law practicum where students can enroll in a practicum and work for assigned counsel defending people earlier in the process. So we actually, this is in addition to a broader attempt to have our criminal law curriculum's practical components really educate students in a variety of areas.
Okay. Bruce, thanks for the phone call. Listeners, if you want to call in with questions or comments, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll free. 844-295-8255, or if you're calling from Rochester, it's 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Our guests are joining us from WBFO in Buffalo. That's the NPR member station there. You're hearing Professor Kim Diana Connolly, the director of the University at Buffalo School of Law's Advocacy Institute. John Goetz is the co-director of the University at Buffalo's Innocence and Justice Project. And student Farina Mendelson is also joining us. She's been a participant from the beginning at the University at Buffalo's Innocence and Justice Project. And the project, again, as you're hearing now, is designed to provide some resources, some help, some support for inmates who feel like there was a miscarriage of justice, and I'd like to walk through how that happens. So, you know, Farina, I'll start with you. You know, you were one of the first students involved in this project, and from what I've read, the first thing you had to do was take a course that that John Nutrino created, and then you could kind of start working with inmates, or how did that work for you?
Yes, before we could even be considered for the project, we would have to take a semester-long class called Post-Conviction Remedies, in which we would learn what a 440 what a 440 motion is, what the grounds are for overturning your conviction or for being found innocent, and all the basics from a state to a federal level until you could go ahead and apply to be on the project.
Okay, and what's a 440 motion, by the way? Go ahead, tell us what that is.
It is basically a post-conviction motion, so it is not in the direct appeal process, where you would allege a number of things, which I think John can elaborate on more thoroughly, but things like you had ineffective assistance of counsel at your original trial, so now you have new evidence that came to light after your trial that you couldn't have brought up in your original trial, and you now believe that that is sufficient evidence to show that you are actually innocent, and believe that your conviction should be, overturned.
Okay, and so, you know, you're one of the original eight students. You take that class, and then take me through the last year. What have you experienced?
Yeah, so basically we came in, eight of us, and the first thing that we did was start looking at the letters that clients have, or inmates have been sending to us. So from all over the country, we have letters coming in of people who have been incarcerated saying that they've been wrongfully incarcerated or asking for our help for a number of things. And sometimes we can look at the letter and say, well, you're asking us for something that we don't have the capacity to do, like helping you in your direct appeal, for example. So we would have to, reject those letters. But for the letters that are within our jurisdiction, what we do is we vet those letters and we look up online and see, for example, what county that individual was convicted in, what they're convicted of, what crime, how long have they been sitting in the prison. And we find out as much information as we can. And if they pass our original vetting process, we send out an application. And that application is a really long application, which details everything that we need to know in order to make a decision. And the inmate then sends us back those applications, and we go through and read them in addition to doing a whole host of other research. So we look up their case, and we look up their attorney who worked on the case. We find out any information we can. If we need to, we contact the inmate and ask them for further information. But basically, we like to give ourselves as much information as we can before we go ahead and make a decision on whether we can take on a case.
Well, I guess let me ask it this way here. I'm going to ask it through a listener's question via email, and Farina, you can address it because I think it relates to this moment in the process. Tim in Pittsford wants to know, do they ever find out through their research that the client is actually guilty? And he says, by the way, it sounds like a great resource they are providing. I would certainly donate. That's from Tim in Pittsford. We also had a question from a listener named Adam who wanted to know if to the attorneys involved, if it matters to you if you know whether the person is guilty or not. So Farina, at this point in the process, it sounds like it does matter. What are you evaluating and how are you making those decisions?
Oh, well, thank you, Tim, first of all. But basically we evaluate whether someone has, for example, filed a 440 motion on their own before, because you can only allege certain things once in front of the court. So if they've already said this to the court and they've been denied, we unfortunately can't go ahead and help them. But we never go through an investigation, I guess, against our client without, I guess, their permission. So we don't go and contact witnesses unless we have express permission from a client. We don't hire an investigator until we're further on in the process. So I think at first it's mostly reading through the paperwork, and it could be from anywhere from 5 pages to 1,000 pages, actually. And we find out as much information about their case as we can and about possible holes in their case and about possible things that were missed originally that we can attack post-conviction.
And to you, how much does it matter, or I'm sure it matters, but how significant is it for you to end up saying, you know, look, I really believe this person, or at least from the evidence, there's really a good cause to believe that something was either there was a miscarriage of justice or it certainly appears it's possible this person did not do what they were convicted of, versus saying, look, you know, based on what we're looking at here, there's no reason to think otherwise.
I think that it's extremely important to make sure that we give everybody a fair process and to make sure that we don't miss anything, because if something had been missed and there was a miscarriage of justice, I think that it's up to us to try to do as much as we can. So I think it's really important to find out as much as we can about it.
Okay, and Farina and I think John and Kim can also address this, and then we'll come back to your phone calls. We've got some great calls lined up here, so stay there if you're on the phones. Just reading that there's essentially two types of cases, and the name of the project suggests exactly that, that there are cases with people claiming they did not commit the crime for which they were convicted, and there are cases of those who were not afforded due process, that something broke down at some point in the process, and that is sort of their complaint there. Farina, is that kind of how it breaks down for you? I mean, do you view it as those two different categories, or is it all kind of in the same category for you?
I think that they're both equally important to me.
Okay.
And a lot of the difficulty with someone who's claiming actual innocence as opposed to something breaking down in the system is sometimes there's a lot less proof, because if you didn't do it, how do you prove that you didn't do it? So I think that it's really difficult going out there and finding evidence that someone actually didn't do it, as opposed to finding a flaw like their attorney didn't investigate something thoroughly, or they weren't given evidence from the prosecutor's office.
Okay. John, what do you think?
I think it's important to also realize, Evan, that we, you know, as lawyers, we have the tools, just like any other profession or any other industry. Our tool is, when we talked about that 440 motion, all that is under the criminal procedure law, there's an area of law that allows us to go back into court for certain legal and or equitable reasons to vacate that judgment, to have the case come back. And I think that, by the way, one of the questions in that 25-page application that we provide is, are you actually innocent? We want to hear what this individual has to say. We also ask them questions like, are you willing to take a polygraph? We want to see what this person has to say, because each individual that contacts us has an important story, and we want to show them respect. Having said that, we have a certain number of lifelines, if you will, that we can actually commit, just resources. We don't have the resources to take on every case. And quite frankly, we do, I think Farina didn't give herself and the other students enough credit in the level of review. And the term vetting is being thrown around an awful lot these days, but we vet. We go through and make sure that we don't miss a particular issue or a particular point. And then this group of students, we work as a team, and we actually want these students to advocate. Like one person in particular, we're reviewing this case very carefully. There's thousands of pages to review, and we've had some students kind of go back and forth as to whether or not they think that this is a case and an individual that we should take on, or at least go to those next steps. So what we try to do is give everybody an opportunity to be heard that contacts us. We give them what I believe is a straight and fair answer as to what the next steps are. And then everybody needs to understand that when we do actually go to those next steps of writing that motion, of getting into the nitty-gritty, so to speak, unfortunately, because of our resources, we have to then tell everybody else, we're still reviewing you, however, you're on hold because we now have the Jones case. I'm just throwing out something [S2] Yeah. [S1] As an example. So we have to be very careful. And I'm going to go back to, you had a great person on a couple Fridays ago now, I think Rufus Cappadocia. And the reason I bring him up is the idea of music. And what we do is we want to make sure we have everything choreographed so that when we finally do the writing, it sings to the judge, sings to the audience, so that when and I use this term adversary only in the sense of the prosecution.
Sure.
When the prosecution sees our name come up, when the judge sees our name come up, they respect the work that went into that motion coming in. We're not going to give, I hate using this word, but we're not going to just hand in garbage. It's going to be the best product, that best tool that we can do to provide justice to our client the way we see it.
Okay, and last question on that, and then we will get to the phones. Listeners have to be wondering, you know, about a year in, how many cases have you really kind of gotten down the rabbit hole on, and what's the status of things?
Well, I think between Farina and I, we can say we get so many letters. So to answer the ultimate question, we are in a process now where there are three individuals that we are going to be, for lack of a better term, voting on to determine if they should go to the next steps. And the next steps would be actually requesting the assistance of an investigator and getting some more feet on the ground to verify the information that we've been able to obtain through the documents and the other materials that we were able to look up. So I think it's a great question, and the answer is right now we don't have any motions out there because we're not there yet. That's how serious we take the process. You know, it's a very significant endeavor to move on with these types of motions. And I think it's worthwhile saying there's only two of these projects in the state of New York. We have the Innocence Project, which strictly deals with DNA, and then we have UB Law School's Innocence and Justice Project, which we don't deal with DNA. We deal with everything else. And sometimes I would suggest that that's harder for folks because DNA, well, either it's there or it's not. And there's some other science that goes into that. But with us, we're looking at, was some type of evidence withheld that would have been exculpatory? That's called a Brady violation. Was there, as Farina pointed out, ineffective assistance of counsel that should have found that alibi witness that the individual said, hey, I had an alibi all along and my lawyer didn't go check it out? Did we have a situation where there was misidentification, which again is really an amazing number when you look at certain types of crimes, how often that type of situation puts people in prison. So right now we have many folks who are applicants, and we have not told them that they are our client yet. And I'll defer to Kim, because once we get to that point, there's a next stage, a next step, if you will, when dealing with the institution.
All right, Kim, go ahead.
Well, what I wanted to say was the many, many hundreds of hours that have been put in are amazing in terms of this project. Bear in mind that the two people who I'm sitting here with is a law student who is very active in extracurricular activities, takes other courses, and is still doing this, but only as part of what she does. And then we have two co-directors who have full-time law practices who are volunteering their time. So this is not something that anybody is doing full-time, but with every moment that they're doing it with a kind of dedication that we hope to have all of the people associated with UB Law and everybody who comes into contact with realize that we are this committed to doing it. So it is a slow process, but in part it's slow because this is not anybody's full-time job.
Makes sense to me. And listeners have been responding all throughout the hour in various platforms. Let's get our only break, and we'll come back to their phone calls and questions and comments about the University of Buffalo's Innocence and Justice Project that we're learning about this hour on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, how much of great comedy is tied to mental illness and personal struggle? We can point to many great comedians who have dealt with their own struggles. John Belushi, Robin Williams, Chris Farley, even Ellen DeGeneres has talked about her own issues. We're going to talk to comedians in Rochester next hour about what's inbounds and out of bounds and how they relate their struggles to their work next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Rose in Rochester, first up on the phones. Go ahead, Rose.
Hi. I first want to say that I'm really pleased to hear about this initiative. I think it's a fantastic resource, especially for people who don't have resources and who didn't have them at the time that they were facing charges. And in terms of a breakdown in the process, I really wish that there was a project similar to this when people are initially facing charges, when they are, you know, countering the DA and all of the resources that they have, and yet they're maybe stuck with a public defender who has too much of a caseload and there's no investigation going on, in terms of their interests. And furthermore, they're in jail, unable to get out because they have no resources to get out, when others who are facing similar or the same charges, if they have resources, they're not in jail. I just wish that this sort of initiative existed in terms of prevention, so that those who are presumed innocent have the opportunity for that sort of investigation and support to prevent them from getting to the point where you're helping them out, when you're helping those who have been proven guilty. And I'm not saying that your initiative and your resources are certainly indicated, but if only there was something to stop that trauma of them getting to where you have to help them when they shouldn't have been there to start with.
Rose, thanks for the phone call. Our guests come to us from the University of Buffalo's Innocence and Justice Project. They're joining us from the WBFO studios in Buffalo, and I'll let them respond to Rose's call. Go ahead, guys.
If I could start, and I'll break it down a little bit, and in an overabundance of transparency and caution, too, I would add that I am personal friends with a number of defenders throughout the state and in the federal system. And I would like to say that Tim Donaher, who, for example, who is the Monroe County Public Defender, and the Marianne Mariano, who is the federal defender for the Western District of New York, and I'm just using those two because it's the largest group of folks that would be engaged. I would suggest that their offices are filled with incredibly dedicated attorneys. So I think what Rose said, by the way, is accurate, which in the sense of resources. That's maybe another, Evan, a great opportunity to speak about that, maybe even next week for Gideon Day for the March 18th date. But the idea of resources, and I think what those attorneys, those defenders would say is they would agree with you, Rose, that we need to, as a society, strongly consider how we get the resources to make sure that an individual is properly represented at that key part in the process. And for our project, we are dealing with a holy cow, something broke down. How do we fix it? And so I think there's two parts to this, which is the resources are making sure that from our perspective, okay, the mistake has happened. How can we try to remedy or fix that mistake? And the resources that are needed at the early stages, I would suggest are needed for us as well, because there's, unfortunately, I think most likely in my lifetime, we'll have a need for these types of projects. And I hope someday that certainly is that I become obsolete. But I don't see that happening. It all comes down to those resources. And we could certainly use the help at the post-conviction level. But I certainly think that the defenders out there would agree that they would love that help at the pretrial, at the litigation level, once those charges have happened.
Can I ask Farina to jump in on this, too, from a particular angle here? When we talk about a breakdown, as John Goetz just mentioned, possible breakdowns, you look back, the holy cow moment, how did this happen? You know, Farina, you've heard from a number of inmates, you've read a lot, you've probably reviewed a number of letters and cases as we've been talking about. What's the most common type of breakdown that you are encountering, either through your work in the last year or just through your studies? You know, the kind of thing that might happen to a defendant who might not have much in the way of resources or means, and you look back and say, I can't believe this was left out, or how did they know? What's the most common type of breakdown?
I would say that I've seen a lot of people who say that they weren't there. So there was a crime occurring and then somebody identified them later down the line. So misidentification maybe. And I'm not entirely sure how that would happen. I think that is all different parts working. So it could be not being thoroughly investigated by many different parts of our criminal justice system. So I think that more resources are needed definitely at every level. So I think that is a funding issue. And we as students try to do as much as we can. Like me, myself, I'm actually a part of the criminal law practicum that Professor Connolly mentioned earlier, and I'm at legal aid this semester. Students are working and not getting paid because they are dedicated to this issue. So hopefully the more that people are engaged and see that they can help and how valuable their help is, that maybe we can finally start to break down these issues. But I think that things being missed early in the stage and maybe, I've seen a lot of people saying that they weren't there and somehow they got pegged for this crime.
Okay. Kim and John, can you also briefly answer that question in terms of the common breakdowns or miscarriages of justice that you see?
Well, Evan, I would suggest there's typically five areas that these breakdowns occur. And the first is sad because it deals with perjury or false accusations. And you know, you can even go back to the Salem witch trials where you had somebody who there was no crime to begin with, and yet they were falsely accused. And then you have another high area dealing with, unfortunately, official misconduct. And that can be from information not provided at the trial level by a prosecutor. It can come from a member of law enforcement hiding materials from a prosecutor or not providing all of the information that they should have provided to that prosecutor so that he or she could do their job. And I know this. I think, as mentioned earlier, we have students that are looking to go into to prosecute. So the prosecutors that I know, and I have many that are friends, applaud this project because they don't want to see guilty people in prison either. Another area, which I think we had mentioned earlier, and this goes back to what Farina said, is that mistaken witness, the mistaken ID. And it happens more than you would think. And unfortunately, many times there's been a fair number of studies to show that it is race-based. And there's actually a great study out there, even not even on the basis of race, but I don't know if your listeners or if you're familiar with the study where they had there's people bouncing a basketball and a guy in a gorilla suit goes through and nobody sees the guy in the gorilla suit because they're so focused on the basketball. And unfortunately, those types of things happen in real life, too, not just in those types of studies. Then you have the misleading evidence. And then finally, going back to what we were saying, that's to Rose's point of the inadequate legal defenses. You have so many people that are out there, and there's only so many attorneys, and there's only so much time in a day. And if you're being told you don't have the resources to do it, well, you either go out and do it yourself, or you might miss a point. And I'm a big believer in team mentality. I think I do a good job individually, but I'd rather have a team of people around me so that if I'm making a mistake, hey, tell me about it, so that we're all on it to take care of that client. So I think those are the biggest areas for false convictions. And I think that it's really backed up by an awful lot of studies that have gone through.
Hmm. I've got to get back to the phones. Bill in Waterloo has been waiting. Go ahead, Bill.
Hi, guys. I just wanted to comment that my sister and brother-in-law had a situation in Michigan, and they ended up acquiring the services of the Innocence Project there. And while he ended up serving his full sentence, everybody in the family and them were very grateful that because they were devastated financially because of their case, it was the only opportunity to be able to afford to at least have their side heard. And the other thing it brought was great awareness to sometimes innocent people can be, you know, convicted, and they have a particular cause. I mean, their story is, you can read it on tornfamily.com, but it was, they wouldn't have been able to come out as best as they could without the Innocence Project. So we're all very grateful.
Bill, thanks for the phone call. Guests in Buffalo, you want to respond to that?
Yes, first, thank you, Bill, and thank you for sharing your family's story. And I think something, there's really a couple of points that Bill makes that I think are important for folks to understand. First, and I'll say this, shameless plug, our law school is in the process of becoming part of the Innocence Network, and that allows us to have the opportunity to say, okay, you're out of our jurisdiction, but hopefully we can get you to the right group or the right entity. But the second part of what Bill was saying is, unfortunately, these folks who come out of prison many times have they've lost everything. They have nothing left. And so how do you compensate for that? And many states don't have statutes available to allow people who have been wrongfully convicted the opportunity to be compensated. And I know it's something that our project specifically doesn't deal with from the immediate end, but it is something that we are dealing with from the awareness end, that we as a society do owe something to these folks who have had, in many cases, decades taken away from them.
Thank you, Bill, for that phone call. I want to get Bruce's follow-up. Bruce from Irondequoit called to follow up and just wanted to know if our guests think, should there be greater penalties for miscarriages of justice? You know, for example, we talked about somebody convicted of a murder they didn't commit and spending more than 17 years in jail. Should the people who helped facilitate that conviction, should there be a greater consequence for that?
Well, I'll speak only for myself. I would say there should be consequences, especially if there's some sort of intent, then the answer is yes. If it's a mistake, I don't think you want to necessarily punish the person for making a mistake. However, I that goes back to trying to correct the wrong for the person who was wronged, you know, so that maybe they have the opportunity to get back on their feet financially when they're out. And I think that's something to strongly review and consider.
Professor Connolly, you agree?
I think that makes a lot of sense. We're not taking a position on it as a law school, but certainly it's something that deserves further study. And I think that's one of the things that's so fabulous about this type of service learning is students can come in, they can work hard, they can explore, they can study, and then they can leave with this experience to pursue other careers, but be part of a justice system, having worked hard in law school, steeped in moral codes and values of being thorough and doing excellent work.
Down to about our last 90 seconds, and I wonder, and I'm going to turn to Farina for the last question here, because she's the youngest person on the panel, and the youngest people are the people who usually listen to more of the podcast, but I suspect everyone on our panel from the University of Buffalo's Innocence and Justice Project is familiar with Adnan Syed's case, which sometimes an issue like wrongful conviction needs a sexy case nationally to really get a lot of support. Now, I don't know that Adnan Syed's case is actually wrongful conviction, but the success of the Serial podcast has launched that into the public eye, and all of a sudden now, well, there's a, you know, there was a motion to bring his trial to reopen that case, and I'm reading now, thanks to Megan Mack, that the Maryland AG appeals the court decision overturning the murder conviction, rejecting the notion that the attorney did not provide a full defense against cell phone evidence. But that's just a case that got national attention. Farina, is that the kind of case that actually helps your work? Is it getting more attention, or is that sort of just a one-off that you don't think is all that relevant to the work you're doing?
Well, I think that there's something to be said about the media picking up on these cases, because I think that bringing awareness is always great, because we need the world to see that these things are possible and that these things are happening. And simply because someone is convicted doesn't mean that they did it. And because of the number of wrongfully convicted individuals, we need to bring more awareness and as much awareness as we can. So I think that things like the Serial podcast and the Making a Murderer show are bringing awareness to how things could go terribly wrong.
Well, Farina, good luck to you. As a third-year law student and a participant at the University of Buffalo's Innocence and Justice Project, now you got a big career in front of you, and thanks for taking the time to share your experience with us on the program today.
Thanks for having us.
John Goetz is co-director. John, where can people get more information about the project?
I'll defer that to Kim.
There you go, Professor Connolly.
Go to the law school's website. The University at Buffalo School of Law has a website through the Advocacy Institute, and this is one of our gems that we have in our Advocacy Institute is our Innocence and Justice Project. So go search there.
It's an Innocence and Justice Project, and I hope John And Kim and future students will come back and update us on the work that you're doing. It should probably be an annual conversation, so let's consider that an invitation. We'll talk again roughly a year, see what's going on, but I want to thank everyone joining us from WBFO in Buffalo. Thanks, John. Thanks, Kim. Farina, thank you so much.
Evan, thank you.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
All right, more connections next.